subject for the closing lecture of the series is Survival of the Christian Family in American Society. I don't believe it is often that we hear anyone talk on this subject, which is really surprising because it is on many people's minds and is frequently the topic of private conversation. One reason, perhaps, for the reticence to speak about the survival of the Christian family is that it sounds so pessimistic, and no one wants to encourage pessimism. Or it may be that the subject cuts across so many basic principles of Christian life and morality that it is safer and less obtrusive to avoid such issues for fear of stirring up emotions or of disturbing people's comfortable complacency. Whatever the reasons for not hearing more about it, whether in lecture or in sermons, there are pressing reasons for bringing the matter into the open, and I just wish I had more than what I'm allowed, about 60 minutes. Among these pressing reasons, the most serious is that the Christian family is, in my estimate, struggling not merely to grow and develop, but to survive in contemporary America, and no amount of soothing rhetoric can prove the contrary. I propose to examine our subject from two angles, then, as I have been doing, to end with a conclusion. The first aspect will be to see concretely and in plain language what are the four pillars of the Christian family. If any one of these, or all four, are threatened, survival becomes increasingly difficult. The second aspect will be to look at the present situation in the United States as affecting each of the four pillars, then a concluding epilogue. We begin then by asking ourselves, what are the four pillars of the Christian family, first preached by Christ and the apostles, and over the centuries recognized as such by Catholic Christianity? They are fidelity, indissolubility, children, and community. Each of these has a library of commentary written on it, and we can hear at very best, only clarify the terminology. The first feature of the Christian family is that it postulates as the foundation of all else fidelity of the married spouses to one another and proscribes any sexual liberties outside the precincts of matrimony. This means that between themselves, the married couple are not only permitted the fullness of sexual experience. Permitted is the wrong word. For too long used by a society that has for too long built on a Calvinistic and not a Catholic morality. You permit something less than good to avoid something worse. Not so in marriage. The marital embrace with complete, wholehearted satisfaction for husband and wife is not only or mainly a sort of concession to human nature to prevent uncontrolled outbursts of passion. That would be permission. No, it is God's own creation to symbolize the deep love between himself and the human race. And whenever God's revelation wants to express the depths of that divine love for man, it uses marital intercourse to symbolize that love. Intercourse, therefore, between married people is their sacrament of marriage, not just entered into when they married, but lived out in practice. And with divine grace is intended to deepen the mutual affection of husband and wife while giving each the opportunity to grow through marital intercourse in their intimacy with God. It is not a coincidence that the same revelation, especially in the New Testament, speaks of heaven with the symbolism of marriage. That's what intercourse is meant to anticipate. But just because intercourse in Christian marriage is so sacred, it is for that reason also exclusive. That, in fact, is a good definition of sacred, exclusive. That is, being reserved for expression and enjoyment between the two who are married. It is sacred because it is their secret. It is the mystery between them. No one, absolutely no one, may enter between them to alienate their affection or intrude on their unique, loving relationship. So clear is the Christian mandate that to leave no room for doubt, Christ explained that if a man even looks at another woman lustfully, he already commits adultery with her in his heart. Indeed, and let's say it, with Christ's coming into the world, the very meaning of adultery was radically changed above anything that the old Jewish law even conceived. For the Jews, adultery was largely a matter of justice. As we might remind ourselves, the text of the last of the Ten Commandments, as given in the book of Exodus, clearly reveals. Let me read it. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is his. Unquote. Exodus. Adultery was forbidden, therefore, because a man's wife, like his house or cattle, were his property. But Christ made fidelity and marriage part of the new covenant of charity, which he said he came into the world to teach as his own new commandment. From Christ, time on, infidelity would become what it had never been before, a crime against love. Our second dimension, indissolubility, consistent with the New Testament teaching on fidelity and marriage, Christianity introduced an unheard-of commandment for the followers of Jesus Christ. They were not obliged to marry, of course. And celibacy was offered as a live option for those who have the vocation. Take it from a man who knows, they better have a vocation. But once a couple married, their wedlock became indissoluble. Words could not be plainer than what Christ said, as recorded by the evangelist Mark. Well to recall that Mark was the secretary of the first vicar of Christ, Peter. Here is Christ recorded by Mark. What God has united, man must not divide. The man who divorces his wife and marries another is guilty of adultery against her. And if a woman divorces her husband and marries another, she is guilty of adultery too. Unquote. Jesus Christ. Since apostolic times, thousands of people have left the Catholic Church. The best statistical figures by Catholic sociologists in the United States is annually in America between 300,000 and 500,000 Roman Catholics. That's every year leave the Catholic Church. because of this, for them, impossible commandment. Correspondingly, whole systems of what I call competitive Christianities have been formed, all taking issue with the express teaching of the Gospels and insisting what admittedly even the disciples of Christ protested, that this is expecting too much of human nature. Nevertheless, the unqualified doctrine remains intact by now a growing number of, may God forgive them, Catholic moralists teaching the contrary. I repeat, the unqualified doctrine remains intact, and the Catholic Church is not afraid or ashamed to proclaim it. A sacramental and consummated marriage between two baptized persons cannot, that's the verb, cannot be dissolved by any human power under heaven until the death of one of the married partners. No one need tell a priest this is a hard doctrine, he knows. The union of baptized people, in the language of St. Paul, is to be a sign of the permanent and certainly irrevocable bond between Christ and His Church. Our third dimension. We are looking at the first of our second aspect of the problem, namely, what are the four pillars of the Christian family? Our third, we say, is children. Not every marriage we know is fruitful in children. And one of the heaviest sacrifices that some couples who so want children are called upon to make is when God does not bless their marriage with offspring. My secretary for 2 years, when I taught at a state university in Michigan, was a wife who was childless. I know when she shared with me her sorrow, what this means. But assuming this, authentic Christianity from the first century has always taught that children are a divinely bestowed gift to husband and wife. As I never fail to mention when I write my congratulations on receiving notice of the first or the latest arrival. As a consequence, that the couple may and should show their mutual affection in many other ways, which I like to point out to husbands, there are many other ways, which, take it from a man, a woman appreciates. But when the couple have intercourse, they may not, without sin, interfere with the life process. By its very nature, so Catholic Christendom believes, and that's what I want to say, believes, on faith. It's a mystery that the conjugal act, while most closely united, husband and wife, makes it possible for them, while giving expression to their love between themselves, gives them the incredible opportunity of loving, listen to this, of loving as only God can love, loving what does not yet exist. Hear it? Only God can love that way, as he must have. He never began to love us. He did from eternity. But bringing his love into action, he brought us from nothing into being. No wonder, begetting a child is called procreation. Cooperating with the divine author of humanity, husband and wife, and I don't mind using the hypothesis, if they are truly Christian, they may find it hard. That's why I'm talking about this subject. But before God, they welcome a child as the most precious blessing from the hands of God. Finally, in the Christian philosophy of life, a family of father and mother and children is not a mere group of persons who happen to be related by blood. It is not even merely a society of individuals who somehow coexist or cohabit with one another. The Christian family is meant to be a community, which implies some remarkable things. It implies there is someone with authority in the family. Someone finally responsible for the ongoing decisions that have to be made. It implies there is mutual trust among the members of the family for the fundamental reason that they are joined together by bonds much more powerful than blood. They are united if they are a true Christian family by love. It implies that the members of a family, in a true sense, live together. They share things together, and together they form an unmistakable unity which we call a community. Already described for us in the early Christian community in the Acts of the Apostles and the letters of St. Paul. So much for the picture of what should be a Christian family. We now turn to the American scene, to our own continental United States. What do we see? To see what is there is not as easy as we may think. For one thing, we are so close to the culture in which we live, surrounded by it like a psychological atmosphere. We are breathing it. But let's remind ourselves, we are now choking. That's what I am talking about. As a consequence of being so close to the atmosphere we breathe, it may take some effort to see through the haze, or seeing what's there, be willing to admit that the Christian family in America is in a state of crisis. Each of the four pillars of the family is being shaken to its foundations by ideas and practices that are opposed on principle to the undiluted teachings of the Christian faith. Let's take each in sequence and just say a few words, restraining ourselves from saying more than we can. Marital fidelity is mocked by a positive mania for sex stimulation, and by now a library of books for women on how to enjoy married men. On my library shelves, that is my own private collection, which I need for the work that I do, is a large section that I suppose you might call hardcore theological pornography. I buy the best and the latest. Let me quote at length from a popular bestseller by a woman author who is also editor of one of America's largest circulating women's magazines. She is arguing in context why a single girl should have relations with a married man. This is what is in his favor, she says. Preferable, therefore, to single men. I'm quoting, and I cut off the quote because I did not want to quote too much. She is urging young women to have married men. He can be your devoted slave, and remain, quote, faithful to you for years. He will love you more passionately than the woman he married and prefer your company to hers. He will spoon-feed you with praise and appreciation you rarely get from a single fellow who thinks telling you that you have pretty eyes might be construed as a proposal for marriage. He is often generous with gifts and money. If he isn't, you can explain to him the economic facts of life. It seems to me, the authoress concludes, the solution is not to rule out married men, but to keep them as pets. While they are using you to varnish their egos, you use them to add spice to your life. I say them advisedly. One married man is dangerous. A number can be fun. Unquote. Millions of American women listen to this kind of advice, and I know. My record of a co-ed at a state university was, and she had not yet graduated, she had had relations, she told me, with 21 married men. Other millions of men are stimulated by lechers like the editors of Playboy, and the resulting pressure from a sex-ridden society makes marital fidelity sound like a strange word you look up in the dictionary, or an oddity practiced in a pre-scientific age. Marital indissolubility, like marital fidelity, is becoming increasingly hard to live up to in a country that has the dubious privilege of being the most divorced society. I'm quoting professional sociologists, the most divorced society in all recorded history. Some figures may help to illustrate what we are saying. We are so used to the phenomenon, we are, as it were, intoxicated and unable anymore to realize what is happening to our culture. The latest official data show that there were 660,000 divorces in the United States the past year. 660,000 against a total of a little more than 2 million marriages. This gives the country a divorce rate of over 30%. Large cities like Los Angeles have a rate way over 50%. Los Angeles, over 70%. And the state of Illinois has one of the highest rates in America. Much higher, if you please, than New York. In fact, percentage-wise and in absolute numbers, the largest in America after California. Social scientists in Europe and Asia write without hesitation that the instability of the American family is almost beyond calculation, and the end is by no means in sight. One of my Jesuit confreres, when I did my studies in Rome, was a former Buddhist, converted to Christianity, by the name of Ignatius Takeuchi. I'd like to share this story with you. We talked about many things walking the streets of Rome. I was teaching him English, and I was picking from him some Japanese. We used Italian as the medium of exchange. We talked about the Second World War, and I asked, how is it that a country as small as Japan would dare take on a giant like the United States? Didn't your people know it was military suicide? No, he said. We were sure we could defeat America. Listen, for 10 years before Pearl Harbor, we were told, week after week, by our press and communications media, that a country whose family is as unstable as America's can be defeated even by the small cluster of islands called Japan. The problem this instability poses for Christians who believe that marriage is for life is, if the instability is beyond calculation, so too is the problem. Millions of divorced persons are legally on the loose, looking for available mates, and become a constant temptation or seduction for husbands and wives who wish to keep their marriage sound. Millions of children stranded by the divorce courts have the memory of a broken home to live down, and often fear the prospects of their family instability when they embark on a marriage of their own. I never thought I would hear this from one of my students at the University in Michigan. Shortly before she was marrying, very happy, ideally matched couple, two fine Christians, both graduating, both intelligent, but she was fearful And the closer marriage approaches, she says, the more scared I get. Why, I asked her. What I'm afraid of is I will turn out like my mother. Our third reflection on children. Children are still looked upon as a blessing by parents whose Christian love has not dried up and whose trust in God is still sometimes heroically strong. But the odds against them are big. Contraception now has the respectability of cultural acceptance in America. And those who want children have to apologize. May God forgive their madness. Apologize for polluting the atmosphere with additional offspring. Abortion is murder in the eyes of God. Do you want to know how clearly Christianity believes that abortion is murder? In the first century, there was a document, not part of the scriptures, that became one of the foundations of the faith and practice of the early church. This document restated the Ten Commandments. When it came to the fifth, which in the Old Testament reads, "Thou shalt not kill," in this first century Christian version, it reads, "Thou shalt not abort." Because the pagan society around the Christians in the first century killed unborn and newly born offspring. So it is murder in the eyes of God. But it has become not only fashionable, in the eyes of the American law, but its defendants sit in the highest judiciaries of the land and occupy, as I know from the Chicago University where I reside, they occupy the highest places in the academic world. Every issue of the Chicago University Maroon has large ads for abortion. Recently, one of my students at the University of Ottawa, where I will be teaching this winter, told me of a conversation she had with a nurse friend of hers in New York City. The nurse told her that her unpleasant task was to look in every hour or so into a hospital room where naked fetuses just aborted were expiring in agony on rows of tables. She would look in, or better, she would listen in only when the last moan of the last living child had stopped were the murdered babies scooped up and thrown into the burning incinerator. It seems there is a New York statute which forbids cremating a living human being. And this is the America where followers of the Christ who love children are expected to keep their faith and love unchanged. Lastly, community life in a Christian family is, as we saw, the fourth pillar that we reviewed before. It is also the pillar that is not easy to maintain. The number of women in the American laboring force is fast approaching the number of men. Not a few women have to work. My widowed mother had to. She lost her husband when he was 26. So they may have to supplement, say, their husband's meager salaries, or they are widowed, or otherwise unattached. We are assuming all of that. But the millions of working mothers in America with young children are hard to square with that community of spirit in a family that only a mother's attentive love can provide. You see, a family has a soul, and a soul must have a heart, and that heart is a mother's love. Correspondingly, the number of agencies and institutions that literally tear the children away from their homes is becoming legion. Do you know that right now, before the American Congress, is the most far-reaching and boldest scheme ever advanced for breaking up the family community? The proposed bill begins with a recital that Congress finds, I quote, that millions of American children are suffering unnecessary harm from the present lack of adequate child development services, particularly during their early years, unquote. To remedy the situation, the bill directs the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to foster programs that will provide, I quote, comprehensive physical and mental health, social and cognitive development services for all children to the age of 14. And all the while, Christian parents believe that the primary right for rearing their children belongs to them and not to the state. That the best place for raising a family is at home and not in an institution. So the recital might go on, all pointing to the stark reality that where millions of parents have shirked their responsibility, thus provoking a massive intrusion by the state, millions of other fathers and mothers are faced with powerful competitors for bringing up their children and not in the pattern of a Christian community. By way of epilogue, I might say that, in one sentence, the Christian family is challenged for survival in modern society, notably in America, because in growing measure, that society has ceased to be Christian. When Christ told his followers to observe all that he had commanded them, he also promised to be with them all days, including the last third of the 20th century in our own United States. His grace, therefore, is assured. All the light and strength we need to maintain the four pillars of a truly Christian family are there, also in our country and today. And I might stop my talk there. God's grace will somehow provide. But I think I should add one more word. Too often we talk about the need for more grace. I don't think the problem is more grace. I think it is the need of using the grace we've got. May I suggest what this means? It means, first of all, on our part, acquiring through such programs as we are finishing this evening, through sound reading, discussion and dialogue, especially through humble prayer, to acquire a deeper understanding of what a Christian family ought to be. And let no one deceive you. What Christ taught in Palestine, though 2,000 years ago, about marriage and the family, is still true and absolutely certain today. Secondly, we must be aware, as never before, of the threat to the Christian family posed by our society. Not to know this is to be disarmed for the conflict that the Savior expects his followers to engage in for the glory of his name. In the last several years, I've discovered something I never knew was in the Gospels. Let me share it with you. Most of you are married. I'm not. My celibacy is challenged. So is your marriage and the family. What I'm now finding in the Gospels is that Jesus Christ told his followers to witness to him before the world. Well, I used to read the New Testament, teach about it, preach homilies, and I guess people were quite impressed with what I had to say about being a witness to Christ. How little I knew. Do you know that the word witness means martyr? Do you know that Christ is telling us to be his martyrs before the world? We know what martyrdom means. It means living for a principle, no matter what it costs. Please God, enough Christian Americans will live up to the challenge placed before us. It is eminently worth our efforts and sweat, and if need be, and it may be, the blood. After all, the life that awaits us is reserved for those who believe that heaven is a great human family where fidelity reigns supreme and loving unity and children have been reared in the love of God. In a word, that heaven is our eternal community. Thank you again for listening. I think we get coffee and cookies, and then we'll have questions after that.